Thank you very much. Please, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. You're very gracious. Please, thank you. Thank you. Let me say what a delight it is to be here with all of you, including those of you who are stuck in Virginia back there. I don't know. I don't know how the hell you got the cheap seats, but I tell you, thank you very much. There's only a few things I've learned in all the years I've been here in Washington, but one I learned for certain. If you want to see your popularity soar, acknowledge and announce you're not running for president. It really is amazing what it does. It's just, if I'd known this, I would have announced it every year for the last 35 years. But thank you. I have had, presumption me to say that one talent that is as good or exceeds anyone else who's ever had my job, and that is I've been able to identify and find and pick and convince people brighter than me to join me. And I mean that sincerely. The two people with the finest minds that I have ever met in my life are Ron Klain and my son Hunter, in terms of just steel trapped minds. I've never met a man or a woman any brighter than Ron Klain. And that's been a great advantage to me from the time he was a kid, and I mean a kid. I hired him. He came down to do his third year from Harvard at Georgetown, graduating from Harvard, because his wife graduated a year ahead of him and came to work for a major law firm down here. And he was recommended to me then. He clerked for the Supreme Court, and everyone thought I was crazy when I asked him to come be chief counsel for the Judiciary Committee. I may have been the second youngest senator ever elected, but I think he's the youngest person ever to head up be chief counsel for the Judiciary Committee. And he has been a brilliant advisor. He's been a brilliant writer, and he's been a brilliant strategist. And so if there is anything in that tenure of my service that is worth noting, it's in significant part because Ron Klain was by my side, and I mean that sincerely. So, Ron, thank you very much for the introduction. Solicitor General Varelli is here. Solicitor General, where are you? I can't see you. There you are. Stand up, man. Stand up. I'm sorry the lights are so bright. I wasn't sure. I want to thank you, and I mean this sincerely, for your dedication, dedicating your entire career — that's not hyperbole — your entire career to the cornerstone of this democracy, and that is the rule of law. There's a reason why so many — you're the longest serving, and so many presidents have turned to you. You have unimpeachable integrity. You have a brilliant mind, and you've demonstrated just an unyielding commitment to the document that you helped interpret or enforce by arguing for the government. And so I want to thank you for the service of the country. But equally as importantly, as Ron can tell you and others who work with me, I judge the genuineness of — I mean this sincerely — the genuineness of a man or a woman with whom I've served either an appointed or elective office by how they conduct themselves when they leave that office, to find out whether it was real or whether it was for some political gain. And your continued commitment to the rule of law, your involvement in this organization, which is — I realize its tenure is not as long as the other outfit. But is — by the way, we talked about it early on — is badly needed. You are badly, badly, badly needed. And you're filling — no, it really is important. I know it sounds like I'm just trying to be — I'm not. I genuinely mean it. The problem is, no one ever doubts that I mean what I say, but the but the problem is, I sometimes say all that I mean, and I mean it. You are really very, very much needed, and thank you. Thank you all for the role you play. It is true, I came back from law school 812 years ago in 1968, and my city, part of it had been burned to the ground. The city of Wilmington, Delaware is the only city in America since the Civil War occupied by the military for a total of 9 months. It's National Guard with drawn bayonets, federal on every single corner in my city. And I had terrible grades in law school, but I was a pretty good communicator. I won the International Moot Court competition, a few other things, and I talked myself into getting a job with a, quote, white shoe law firm that was the oldest law firm in the state of Delaware. And after a case in federal court, which, and it was a fine firm, where we were defending a major oil company, and we won, and I had written as before I got admitted to the bar. Those days you took the bar in September, it's still that way in Delaware. You take it in September, you don't get your results until December, it's given once a year. But I was sitting in the second chair with a senior partner, I wrote a brief for a directed verdict in this case, and we won. And it was reason to celebrate, but I looked over at the defendant and I thought, oh God, you know, we upheld the law, but this poor kid is in real bad shape. He was injured cleaning out a containment vessel in an oil company. And the senior partner, who was a good man, DuPont, invited me to go to lunch at the Wilmington Club. That is in Delaware. There were no Catholics or blacks or Jews allowed in that club, and it was considered a great honor for me to go to the Wilmington Club. I demurred, and I walked out of the courtroom, walked across Rodney Square. If any of you had any corporate cases in Delaware, you know what I mean, across from the federal courthouse. Went to the basement of a building that was catty corner, walked into the public defender's office, a guy named Frank Kearns. And I said, Frank, I'd like to come to work for the public defender's office. He said, don't you work for Prickett? I said, yes. He said, are you crazy? From that moment on, my judgment has been questioned by everyone in the state of Delaware. You think I'm kidding? I'm not kidding. But I learned early on, man, what you've all learned. There's a lot of people who are successful and not happy. If you want to be successful and happy, work like hell and do what you believe in. And that's what all of you do, and that's why you're involved in society. Apparently, I have not made many bones about it. I am a fan of Elizabeth Warren. She's a great personal friend, and I missed her speech before you tonight, but I got to see her outside before we left, and we compared notes and on a number of things. And she told me, just go up and say thank you and leave. Look, I know you asked me here tonight to speak about the unprecedented dysfunction that the Senate is literally spreading to a third branch of government, our highest court. But there is a fundamental issue that I'd like to raise briefly, which I think is related to the issue, before I begin specifically on the refusal to hold a hearing for Chief Judge Merrick Garland. And that is that I believe that, and I have not been one, and Ron can tell you, I'm not really big on engaging in, even if it's justified, attacking another, an opponent in a campaign or being negative. But we've sort of crossed the line here. The Republican presidential nominee, I believe, and I mean this literally, this is not a political point, I think his conduct is literally undermining and threatening and potentially doing damage to the constitutional imperative of an independent judiciary that the American people can have faith in. It matters. It matters that the people have faith in the impartiality of the court. Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist 78, he said, "The complete independence of the courts of justice is peculiarly essential for a limited constitution. To guarantee that independence, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, to protect against political pressure, the framers included the Emoluments Clause, the Compensation Clause, which restricts the ability of either branch of government to reduce a judge's compensation while they're in office, life tenure, removal only by impeachment and a supermajority impeachment in the United States Senate." Pretty, pretty bold and provocative at the time, statements of, we expect this branch of government to be co-equal, independent, and it's essential that its believability, there's confidence of the people. It's like Mussolini's comment, how many regiments does the Pope have? Well, you know, what does the court have? What does it have? It has its reputation that it is in fact impartial. That is in fact prepared to rule on the merits. That it is not subject to intimidation. That's a precious, precious, precious commodity that in our separation of powers, the court cannot afford to have undermined. All these protections were designed to do two things: reinforce in the minds of the public the absolute impartiality of the federal judiciary, the Supreme Court in particular, and protect the federal judiciary from being able to be influenced by either of the political branches. The framers gave concrete substance to the idea that ours is, as Chief Justice Marshall put it, a government of laws and not of men. It sounds almost like a high school civics class, but it's real. It's consequential. It really matters. Look at the lengths even a divided court has gone to over our history on extremely divisive subjects to make sure, even though they had enough votes, to get a preponderance beyond a single vote so that they would say to the country, this is the law of the land. You know, the fact is that the founding fathers, in my view, did not think, to quote a perceptive commentator who wrote just a couple days ago, the federal courts, litigation in the federal courts, is not deal-making by another means. Surely the framers of our Constitution did not envision a presidential candidate of one of the major political parties personally attacking a sitting federal judge as the nominee or the presumptive nominee of a major party, attacking a federal judge because that judge ruled against the candidate in his private capacity as a citizen in a civil case. For a candidate to call a judge a hater, a total disgrace, to quote him, because he allowed people claiming to have been victimized by the candidate in his capacity as a private businessman to proceed, and because the judge dares to unseal some documents, which is in his power to do, detailing their victimization, I don't think the framers envisioned a presidential candidate accusing a judge of being incapable of reaching a fair decision because of his ethnic descent, because he was Hispanic or anything else, because he was from Tennessee, or because he was from Delaware, because he was or she was anything identifiable as distinct from who the candidate was. Because, he says, the judge ruled against him in light of his anti-Mexican proposals. Mr. Trump isn't unique in attempting to intimidate the federal judiciary in a case. Other private citizens have tried to pressure the judiciary from time to time, but not private citizens who are placed in close range of the White House by one of our great political parties. It's one thing for a private citizen to attempt to throw his economic or political weight around as an unelected official, to try to influence, help him demolish his adversary, a phrase often used by this particular fellow, in a judicial proceeding. It's quite another thing for the presumptive candidate of a major party to do the same thing. And up to now, you may say, well, Joe, and folks, I have not been out responding to, in my capacity as vice president, to anything that Mr. Trump has said. But it's my view that a presidential candidate who publicly attacks a sitting federal judge who ruled in a way that was against his own economic interests cannot be trusted to respect the independence of the judiciary as a president. Again, you may view this as I'm sure for those who are saying, and with good reason, well, I think that's a particularly harsh judgment. But there's no real connection here. Let's look at what that presumptive nominee said. His own words. After calling the judge presiding over a fraud suit against him a total disgrace, Mr. Trump said, and I quote, these are his exact words, but, quote, but we will come back in November. Wouldn't that be wild if I'm president and I come back and do a civil case? He went on to say, and I'm quoting, wouldn't it be wild as president to come back in November to do a civil case? How can that be interpreted in any other way than as a direct threat? These are words of someone who sees our federal judiciary not as an independent branch of government, but as a tool for him to manipulate so he can do what he calls deal with the laws of our country. These are words, in my view, of one who would defy the courts if they ruled against him as president. Not just in a business case, but a case challenging government abuse of power. Raising the specter of, quote, coming back in November, quote, doing a civil case from the Oval Office is not so veiled a threat. It's a direct threat. And to use the office of the presidency, were he to acquire it, to intimidate and undermine an independent judiciary would be blatantly unconstitutional abuse of power. Either Mr. Trump, which is possible, doesn't understand. I mean, necessarily, he's a bright guy. I'm not saying that, not pretending he's, but he either doesn't understand because this is a realm in which he's never dealt before, or he doesn't care. that it would border on an impeachable offense for a president actually to use the great powers of the office to attempt to undermine a federal judge by placing pressure on that judge in any case, especially one the president has, in this case, a personal financial stake. This kind of conduct is pernicious and unprecedented, and the legal profession should not remain silent, should not put up with it. As one prominent conservative legal commentator put it this way, this behavior in a president smacks of authoritarianism and tyranny. I agree with that commentator. You all know this as well or better than I do. Our founders created an independent judiciary because, as Hamilton wrote in Federalist 78, quoting Montesquieu, there is no liberty if the power of judging is not separated from the legislative and executive powers. I find Donald Trump's conduct in this regard reprehensible, evidenced by the bipartisan condemnation of the action for what it is, a dangerous attack on a vital pillar of democracy, the independent judiciary, by threats of intimidation, and undercutting the legitimacy of a judge by suggesting that because of his heritage, he's incapable of being fair. In addition to this, it is racist. In addition to this. But it's not the racism that frightens me. We've dealt with racists before. It's the potential impact on the court. And I might add a friendly note to my Republican friends, many of them longtime colleagues in the Senate. They assail Trump's unacceptable and wrong censure of the judiciary, yet they refuse to confirm a judge of unquestionable credentials to the Supreme Court so that Mr. Trump can nominate, fill that vacancy. If he were to win. The failure of my friends, and by the way, this is not a joke. It drives, as I can see, some of the White House senior personnel here. It even drives them crazy. I have so many Republican friends. No, you think I'm joking. If you notice, as they'll tell you, anytime we have a crisis, send Joe. It's like that old commercial for Life cereal. Mikey will eat it, you know. Send Joe. It's because with all this dysfunction, I still genuinely respect the Senate. It's the greatest honor of my life has served in the United, to have served in the United States Senate as long as I have. And the vast majority of my Republican colleagues know better. This is an age of intimidation by gigantic contribution capability from certain areas and because of the consequence of gerrymandering. But the bulk, the reason I don't lose faith is the bulk know better. The bulk know better. The failure of the Senate Republicans, though, to even hold a hearing on an eminently qualified Chief Judge Merrick Garland, it has its own grave, practical, and consequential constitutional consequences. When our framers drafted the Constitution, they envisioned separateness but interdependence, autonomy but reciprocity. That's what they envisioned. Otherwise, there's no way these three equal branches of government could function for the well-being of the Republic. It's just as Robert Jackson wrote, while the Constitution diffuses power, the better to secure liberty, it also contemplates that practice will integrate and disperse powers into a workable government. He goes on to say, it enjoins upon its branches separateness but interdependence, autonomy but reciprocity. In 7 years as Vice President of the United States and 36 years as United States Senator, half of those as either the ranking member or chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I've seen the spirit of interdependence and reciprocity work, but I've never seen it at a lower ebb. Not among our people, but among our government, in our government. The bonds that held together our diverse republic for the past 229 years are at least temporarily being frayed. Article 1 of the Constitution clearly states, whenever there is a vacancy for the one court specified in the Constitution, the Supreme Court, the President shall, not may, shall appoint someone to fill that vacancy with the advice and consent of the United States Senate. President Obama fulfilled his constitutional responsibility. He sought the advice of members of the Senate, including Republican members. He didn't get much feedback, but he chose the course of moderation. I will not take the time to list the number of senior Republicans who have been flattering in the past about Merrick Garland, a man that Ron and I and many of you have known for many years. Matter of fact, the criticism the President got is on the left for choosing moderation. With Ron's help, I wrote a long piece, the American Bar Association meeting back in 1917. talking about how what the role of the Senate was and what advice and consent meant, arguing in that a number of law review articles we wrote, arguing that the President should seek the advice. He needs the consent, but he should seek the advice. And the more divided the government, the more appropriate it is for the Senate to raise its head, because it has just as much of a right to determine who should be in the court as the President. The President is to propose, the Senate dispose of the proposal. Yet the Republicans in the Senate have totally abdicated their responsibility by refusing even to hold a hearing in the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, which was not, it's not required to hold a hearing under the Constitution. For the longest time, none were held. Folks, as the old joke goes, I've been in the majority, I've been in the minority, I've been in the majority. The majority's better. But I really do, I think most people would acknowledge, I really do have a good relationship with both sides of the aisle when I was there and since I left. But I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen anything like this. The dysfunctional Congress is beginning to undermine the norms of how we conduct ourselves as a government. It's not only in violation of the notion of fairness, but it's in violation of their constitutional responsibility. And it jeopardizes the highest court of the nation being infected with the same dysfunction that is not only recognized by the American people, but recognized by heads of state everywhere I go. I think the White House staff here to tell you, close to the President, will tell you that I've traveled over 1,100,000 miles. And the reason I go for the President, I know these heads of state personally, and they know when I speak for the President. It's an advantage the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of Defense doesn't have. That's the purpose. And I'll work out an agreement. And you know, I'll reach across the table and shake hands. And here's what they'll say to me. Not a joke. All right, Mr. Vice President, whether I'm in China, whether I'm in Ukraine, whether I'm in Japan, whether I'm in any European country, here's what they'll say. Not a joke. I'll hold their hand and they'll say, shaking hands, and they say, but can you deliver? Not does the President mean it. Not do you mean it. But every deal requires some give, So you're asking me to go out there and support this. I'm going to take some heat to my people for doing it. And I'm not sure whether you'll be able to deliver. I know you mean well. That's how deep the dysfunction of the Congress has spread. Let me be clear. What you all know, advice and consent includes consulting and voting. Nobody has suggested, particularly me, that any senator has to vote yes on any particular nominee. Voting no is their right and their option. It's an option of every senator to be able to exercise the right to vote no. But saying nothing, seeing nothing, reading nothing, hearing nothing, and deciding in advance to do nothing before the president even names a nominee is not an option our founders contemplated. Or, and I would argue, or one that the Constitution leaves open. In my time as the ranking member or chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I presided over 8 justices, 9 total nominees of the Supreme Court, more than anyone alive, I'm embarrassed to say. I've supported most, I've voted against some. But every single nominee got a hearing. Every single nominee got out of committee to the Senate floor. Even those nominees who did not receive a majority vote in the committee, because I believe the Constitution says the Senate shall advise and consent, not the Judiciary Committee. Every single nominee, including Justice Kennedy in an election year, got an up and down vote by the United States Senate. Not much of the time, not most of the time, every single time. Now, unable to square their unprecedented conduct, which they began to call the Biden rule, until they realize what the Biden rule is, the Constitution. My friends, and they really are my friends, Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley. My friends are now trying another tact. They ask, what difference does it make whether there are 8 or 9 members of the court? By the way, at one point we had 8 members in our history. At one point there were 8. It's not always been 9. But I believe, and I'm sure you do, that it makes a great deal of difference. We all know that the Supreme Court's rulings make a significant difference in the everyday lives of the American people. More than 2 centuries ago, Justice John Marshall famously declared the court, quote, has the duty, not has the right, has the duty to say what the law is. Not an opinion, a duty. The Supreme Court has a solemn duty. And disabling the court, which is so clearly ideologically divided at this moment, as it has been in other times in our history, by keeping a seat vacant for hundreds of days, because that's what it'll end up being if we don't get a vote this year, matters not just because of the uncertainty it perpetuates, but because of the way it fractures our country. None other than Justice Scalia wrote, if you have 8 justices in the case, it raises, he said, the possibility that by reason of a tie vote, the court will find itself unable to resolve the significant legal issues presented by the case. We've seen it already, just in the past few months. Pressing controversial issues that prompted the court to grant review in the first place. In most of those cases, because of a different decisions in the different circuits, now remain unresolved. Issues the court believe are too important to leave in limbo are left in limbo, suspended in midair. A 4-4 court, which may be functioning fine in the narrow sense that a majority of cases are able to be decided, has many deleterious effects. Increased litigation cost and delays. Justice delayed, justice denied. So the burden falling more heavily on average Americans than on those with deep pockets able to decide which district to move on and move in. Different rulings in different parts of the country. And such a divided court leaves different interpretations of the law to stand in different states, creating confusion and uncertainty. It's already happened. And keep in mind, we have another entire term of this potential confusion if the vote is not allowed this year. Anybody who thinks that whatever the next president is, and God willing, in my view, it will be Secretary Clinton, but whoever the next president is, no, I don't say that for political reasons, but whoever it is, even if it is a Democrat, the idea this will be brought up within a month or two or three is highly unlikely. Even in a functioning system, it averages over 2 months. So it's critical we have a fully staffed court that can resolve important decisions. If the conflicts between the federal courts of appeals are allowed to stand, we end up with a patchwork of the Constitution and federal law inconsistent with equal justice and equal application of law in America. Federal laws that apply to the whole country will be constitutional in some parts, but unconstitutional in others. That could mean claims of race or sexual discrimination could come out one way in California or Arizona, another way next door in Utah or Colorado. Claims of government interference with religion could have one fate in Ohio and Iowa and another fate in Illinois and Wisconsin. Claims of unlawful policing might be resolved by one standard in Nebraska and another next door in Kansas. I spoke of this 2 months ago at Georgetown Law, and just in the intervening weeks, there have been important cases in which the justices have basically decided not to decide. I don't have to go through those cases. You know them as I do. Just ask the Solicitor General. He knows them all by heart. The meaning and extent of our federal Constitution, our constitutional rights, freedom of speech, freedom to follow the teachings of your faith, to determine what constitutes the teaching of your faith, the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, all could depend on if we keep going this way and where you live. I think most people in this country think that's unfair and unacceptable. We are, after all, the United States of America. Either the Constitution protects rights across the board, or it doesn't. The American people deserve to be a fully staffed Supreme Court of nine. No one, not one disabled and divided, but one that is able to rule on the great issues of the day, from separation of church and state, whether there is a threat to the right of abortion or safe and legal abortion. Police searches, it goes on. I don't, this is the last audience I have to list the concerns to. These are actual cases before the Supreme Court of the United States. We have to be sure that a fully functioning court is in a position to address the significant issues, and the geographic happenstance cannot fragment our national unity. The longer this high court vacancy remains, the more serious the problem will become, and the more we undermine the confidence in the courts. Back to that issue of confidence. The problem is compounded by turbulence, confusion, and uncertainty about our safety, our security, our liberty, our privacy. This is an uncertain time in the minds of many Americans. I need only have you look at the election process so far. And I'm not talking about one candidate. I'm talking about the process. A problem that will affect the future of this country, not only for our children, but for our grandchildren. We can't let this stand. And so I urge you to keep up the drumbeat, because I promise you, they know better. I've spoken to 17 of my colleagues on the other team. And because I've never violated a confidence, I will not say to the press who they are. But I mean it. I'm serious. You start off by saying, Joe, I know you're right. I know you're right. I've gone so far as to tell half a dozen of them, look, I'm not asking you to step out first because I know it could cost you in your state. I'm not asking you to do that. But I'm asking you, if anybody steps out, step up. Step up. I think it's still possible. I think it's still possible we can have a hearing before this Congress adjourns sine die. I think we can resolve this. But the one thing I'm certain of, it will only be resolved if the pressure is unrelentingly kept up. If we continue to point out in the states of the senators that you know better, if we keep the drumbeat, not with a personal attack, but making the case why it's so important. So my closing comment to you is, stay at it. Nothing ever comes easy in this system, particularly right now. But the fact of the matter is, the vast majority of the members of the Senate know in what disregard the Senate has held at this moment. They know that they have to change it. I'm not asking any one of them to appear in the second edition of the Profiles in Courage. I mean it sincerely. But someone will, and when they do, I expect the rest to follow. And we don't need all of them. We don't need all of them. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for all you do. I get paid big bucks to do my job. You don't. I know all of you wish you had my salary. I know that. But all kidding aside, you're among the most respected voices in the nation. You're recognized for your intellect, your integrity, and your devotion to the Constitution. So it matters. You keep writing. You keep speaking. You keep an unrelenting effort to get a hearing. Because if we get a hearing, we got the judge. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops.
Thanks.